From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Jose.
Oakland.
Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Yeah, same here, Half Moon Bay.
Coming up, we continue our series following a new Oakland teacher. Today's lesson, classroom management.
When you've got what feels like 35 kids bouncing off the walls, it's really hard not to sink to their level.
Then a local student struggles to connect with the materials she's being taught.
Whoever was choosing these books seemed to have put effort into creating a diverse collection of stories and authors, but hadn't thought that it was important to include women.
And we'll take a history class in the Marin Headlands.
These sculpted hillsides are actually the ramparts of the gun batteries.
Reading, writing, and ramparts today on Cross Currents. Have you ever had to command the attention of nearly three dozen teenagers? It's not easy, especially when you're still learning how to be a teacher.
Classroom management, I think, it's about control. Control of the students, sure, yeah. But it's about control of self. It's about demonstrating to them how an adult behaves.
That's Diana Arbus. Yesterday, we took you inside her first semester as a student teacher at Oakland High School. Arbus is learning to lead in the classroom with the help of her CT, or coordinating teacher. Diana has felt a sense of responsibility to her students from the beginning.
To have that experience and live it every day, and be the English teacher who stands at the front of the class and looks out at these faces that look like mine and share my experience too, and just say, I'm your English teacher, and, you know, my parents are immigrants too. I was just so moved.
But by December, when we left off, let's just say she was ready for a break.
At this point, at the end of the semester, when I'm just so, I've given everything away. Like, everything is gone. The gas tank is below empty.
What she quickly realized is if she was going to prepare these kids for adulthood, she would first have to command their respect in the classroom. We return to her diaries in January. And a note to our listeners, we've covered up students' names to protect their identities.
It's Sunday, January 27. It's around 8:30 p.m. and tomorrow we kick off our Warriors Don't Cry unit.
Thinking about Warriors Don't Cry, I'm just saying. If we're thinking about Warriors Don't Cry, who is a target?
And Warriors Don't Cry is a memoir written by a woman who is telling about the time that she was part of the Little Rock Nine, this group of African-American students who are the first to integrate an all-white high school in the South. And it just occurred to me that we're going to talk about Jim Crow, desegregation, the civil rights movement, and nobody in my class is white. You know, how weird is that? Where are their white peers going to school? You know, I feel ill-equipped to teach this. I don't know. What would I do differently? I wish I could team teach this with a history teacher. But my ninth graders don't take history. Oh my gosh. We need history teachers.
Okay, everybody. Once you get in a square. And that's the little cootie catcher.
Oh, cootie catcher.
So we're going to create
It's Wednesday, January 30, 10:30 p.m. So this morning, I just about had enough with the class because I had a lesson planned out and we didn't get to 90% of it. Now, half of it is my fault. I'm still new. I'm getting back into the groove of teaching. But this morning, I really needed my students to meet me halfway and just to show me basic respect. People talked back to me. They were walking across the room. Two students were found by the school officer wandering the halls. Unacceptable. And the rest of the year can't be like this. And the thing is, I'm excited about the material we're going to cover this year. But we're not going to get to any of it because of our classroom management issues. So I said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to call your parents at home. And then I went on with the rest of my day. I went to my grad school. I was in 2 research seminars tonight. And I got 4 phone calls in a row from his father. And when I finally called him back in between seminars, his father was livid. He completely ripped into and I felt it. You know, I wasn't the one being scolded, but oh man, that hurt. His angry father saying, "What is wrong with you? You know better. You apologize to your teacher." And then I called another parents. How many more of these can I take?
Yeah, so can you say your name and what grade you're in?
My name is Jeff, and I'm in the 9th. Miss Arbin's too nice. Like, you know, she needs to work on just taking control over the class a little bit because they get noisy sometimes. Or, like, give the kids a little scare, you know what I'm talking about?
It's Monday, February 4, 5:30 p.m. I'm really frustrated. I'm frustrated. Today was still pretty awful. I called 3 parents during third period today, and I am just going to make phone calls until this works. I don't know. So this came in the mail today. You know what that is? That's my way of calling their attention now. I'm going to try it tomorrow for the first time. It's a cowbell. Seriously. So it's pretty awful, right, that I have a cowbell? But something needs to happen. I've tried different things. I've flicked the lights. I've done the clapping thing where you go, if you hear my voice, clap once, clap. If you hear my voice, clap twice, clap, clap. You know, that doesn't work after a while. I've tried voices off in 3, 2, 1. That kind of worked. But I think I'm going to use this cowbell. I don't like it. I don't like this. I need it to work out. How does it work out? What are the answers? Someone needs to tell me the answers. It's Tuesday, February 5, 6:30 p.m. Today was crazy. I used the cowbell, which, oh gosh, it didn't work. It didn't work. And I shouted, I yelled, and they got quiet immediately. I hate yelling, but sometimes you just need to let them know that you get mad. But just not all the time. I can't be mad all the time. Oh my gosh.
When kids acted out, they would do things like break up into group work, and these groups would not stay as groups. The cell phones would come out and they'd be all on Facebook. And I remember one student, this drove me absolutely crazy. Today, took a phone. He just walked across class. He took a phone out into the hallway and went out there. I said, "What are you doing? You should be in your seat. We should be discussing this book." And he said, "Oh, I'm on the phone with my mom." I said, "No, give me your phone now." And I was in the hallway. And I knew the students had their ears perked up, and I knew they were watching and listening. So I said, "I'm sorry, I'm going to have to write a referral and call security." I said, "Okay, do it, you know?" So we're having a showdown in the middle class. I'm frustrated because I want to get to the material, but also I recognize that examples need to be made, and not like meaningless examples. That's what I'm so fueled by right now, is that I'm learning that discipline is okay. Discipline is good. Keeping the students in line is showing how much I care about them and their education. And something happened today where all this was going on. There's like students whispering to each other, oh my gosh, Ms. Arvison is on a roll. And I said, well, what I'm learning from Warriors Don't Cry is that for people of color like us, there are already so many obstacles to us getting a better education. And I get so upset when we make it harder for each other to get that education by having our phones out, by being disruptive, by all this. And we should help each other get through the education system. We shouldn't hold each other back.
That's Diana Arbus, a new teacher at Oakland High School. We're listening to the radio diary of her first year as a student teacher in Oakland. Our series is produced by KALW's Martina Castro. Tomorrow, Diana tries to help her students beat the academic odds.
Too many of them are getting D's or F's in the second semester of the school year, and a lot of them are my students. So I am angry because this is the beginning of high school. It's not the end of it.
That's tomorrow in Diana's Teacher Diaries. Are you a teacher? What was it like when you were training? Tell us about it on Facebook or Twitter at KALW. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. We heard from a teacher. Now we'll consider some thoughts from the other side of the classroom. High school students are looking for material to connect with that they can relate to. In this next commentary, student Francis So from the Ruth Asawa School of the Arts in San Francisco realizes she's not connecting with her work as much as she could, and that there's a specific reason why.
Lately, I've been thinking about English class. I'm a junior in high school, which means that by now I've been assigned a lot of books to read, a diverse collection of books, books by English speakers and translated books, and biographical books and fictional books, and books about oppression and the human condition. But a few months ago, I realized I hadn't ever been assigned a single book written by a woman, at least not since high school had started, and I was over halfway through. How come all the books I was reading were written by men? At first, I was just angry. Whoever was choosing these books seemed to have put effort into creating a diverse collection of stories and authors, but hadn't thought that it was important to include women. What worried me even more, though, was this. How come I hadn't noticed earlier? I'd like to think I'm pretty aware of the world around me, especially when things concern me directly. How come I'd never noticed that teachers weren't assigning female writers? And how come nobody else seemed to have noticed? When I told my English teacher about this, he seemed surprised too. That's crazy, he said. He said he hadn't noticed it either. It just hadn't occurred to anyone. I started thinking about the books I like to read for fun, the books I buy after checking them out from the library because I can't get them out of my head, the books that stay in piles by the side of my bed since I read them too often to put them back on the bookshelf. I thought of David Foster Wallace and of Haruki Murakami. But then I realized I couldn't think of very many women. I thought of all the books I had read recently, and came to the same conclusion. I just wasn't reading female authors. Coming to terms with this was hard. It meant I couldn't just blame the school for this lack of exposure. I was guilty, too. Still, it didn't make sense to me. Why wasn't I reading these writers? I know they exist. In my creative writing class at school, and in every creative writing workshop I've been a part of, most of the students are female. I know a lot of young female writers, but very few young male writers. And yet, when it comes to the publishing world, everything switches. Women are much less frequently published than men. Most of the big publishing houses publish very few women, and in comparison, an overwhelmingly large amount of men. In 2011, for example, the magazine The New Republic found that only 37% of the books published by Random House were written by women. I don't think this is a conscious choice on the publisher's part, just like it wasn't a conscious choice for my school, for my teachers, or for me. I think it's the culture's choice. The roots of our world are patriarchal. We come from a history that marginalizes women. These days, people are working towards creating a more equal society, which gives voices to women as well as other underrepresented groups. If we want to be a part of this effort, we need to notice the areas that are still shrouded by biases, like the literary world. Recently, I've been more aware of what I'm reading, who it's by, and why. I've been consciously searching for women writers. My bookshelf, I think, deserves their voices.
Frances So is a student at Ruth Asawa School of the Arts in San Francisco. Her commentary was edited by Maya Ip and produced by Alyssa Kapnick and Casey Miner. What women-authored books have been significant for you? Share your literary suggestions on our feedback line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll turn our attention to another subject, history. San Francisco's the city of the Summer of Love, a place famous for peace rallies and liberal politics. So a newcomer to the Bay Area may feel confused at the number of forts and military bunkers clustered around the Golden Gate. Well, until recently, large parcels of land in San Francisco and northward in the Marin Headlands belonged to the Army, which was charged with protecting what was then the West Coast's most important port. Today, that land is part of the National Park System, and the military relics there provide a three-dimensional display of the history of seacoast defense in the country. In the mid-19th century, when the U.S. Army took power from the Mexicans, it started to put up castle-like brick forts to guard the mouth of the bay. But during the Civil War, these proved to be imperfect. As war raged on the East Coast, they crumbled under fire from ironclad battleships. As a result, here on the Pacific, the Army built earthwork defenses instead. By the end of the 19th century, the Army was constructing concrete batteries with pits to fit bigger, more powerful guns. Only the half-ton shells were stored underground. And brought up to ground level by a hand-cranked hoist, as park historian Stephen Haller explains.
Took a lot of cranking, as you can see, because it had to be geared down, way, way down, so the strength of two people could lift the shell all the way up to the top. So that amount of cranking got it, what, 6 inches up?
Airplanes came into use in World War I, so the next generation of gun batteries moved completely underground just before World War II to escape detection from the air. The advent of nuclear warheads and long-range missiles made the underground batteries obsolete. The Bay Area at one time was host to 12 nuclear missiles located from the Marin Headlands down to Pacifica. The nuclear missiles were removed in the early 70s. Today, only the disarmed batteries and bunkers remain, around 40 of them filling the hills around the Golden Gate. In our next story, KALW's Mary Reese takes us inside one of the gun batteries that was active in the Marin Headlands during World War II.
Hikers enjoying the fresh air and views from the trails above Fort Cronkite can see the old wooden army barracks lined up near the beach. They'll also find some of the bunkers built into the many hills. But unless they time it right, visitors may never know exactly what went on underground at this former military outpost. I'm with park historian Stephen Haller and retired park ranger John Martini, and they're taking me and a group of young campers inside Battery Townsley, one of the largest in the Headlands.
So what you got to do is stay together. Remember, it's going to be a little dark until your eyes get used, so make sure you're looking down, you don't trip over stuff.
Okay.
We enter echoey rooms linked by concrete hallways. The lights are dim. It's cold. I see a track and pulley system along the ceiling. It was used to carry shells to the outside door. There, a former gun pit has filled with water and become a pond for breeding newts. We stop to look at a disarmed shell.
So is it bigger than you?
Yep, it's totally bigger than me.
You think it's heavier than you?
Like 1,000 pounds or something.
It's not a missile, actually, but at 2,000 pounds, the shell weighs as much as a small car and fits a 16-inch gun barrel. The guns here at Battery Townsley never fired on enemy ships during World War II. The ships never came close enough to be a threat. But the soldiers did do a lot of target practice, sending shells 25 miles out to sea.
You could hear it all over the Bay Area when these guns fired.
Retired park ranger John Martini now directs restoration of Battery Townsley as a volunteer.
The nearest neighbors were either soldiers who had no say, or they were cows on the other side of the hill. Oral history with some of the ranchers is the cows would just like not give milk for a couple of days every time they had target practice.
About 150 soldiers lived inside the battery, underground, full time. They worked in 48-hour shifts and took turns sleeping on steel bunks hung from the walls on chains.
Because every time the guns fired, it was such a powerful shockwave, it would rip the beds off the walls, so the beds had to be chained up and latched down every time they fired a bullet.
Shooting giant slugs at a 50-foot-long target raft had more to do with mathematics than marksmanship. It depended on a network of observation posts located at different heights to see above and below the fog. With bearings from three different telescopes, the plotters could triangulate.
And they would figure out where the ship, if it stayed on that course, was going to be, say, in another minute. And they would relay that information up to the guys at the gun with some variables corrected. Wind direction, atmospheric pressure, temperature in the magazines where the gunpowder was stored. Hotter the day, the more kick the gunpowder gives. Wear and tear on the gun barrel, the rotation of the earth while the shell's in flight. All these things were figured in by hand. Aiming points were given to the gun, and the men in the plotting room would say, okay, at the mark, fire.
However, without actual enemy ships to shoot at, Martini says life inside the batteries grew dull for the soldiers.
Right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was like the adrenaline that they really thought they might be in action. By the time you got to like 1943 and the Japanese were, you know, being pushed way back, it was obvious it wasn't going to affect them here. That was the most boring time.
That's not to say the soldiers were idle. When not firing the big guns, they were painting and polishing, taking inventory, and maintaining hydraulic and electrical systems. During their free time, soldiers could read in their bunks, play cards, listen to the radio, or step outside behind the battery to smoke.
He was a famous trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft.
We continue our tour and stop inside one of two cavernous gunpowder storage rooms. Martini reads a message that a soldier left on a wall in chalk in 1940. His note about the lot is still here.
Like a parking lot. Number 4353, which is this room, of 1940, 150 cans. The cans weren't like little cans. The cans were like garbage cans made of aluminum. And inside these very fancy aluminum cans was the powder for firing the gun.
Remember, that gunpowder was powerful enough to punch a solid steel one-ton shell to the horizon.
Each can had about 200 pounds of powder in it. What is it, 30,000 pounds? Okay, no smoking anywhere in here. They didn't even wear shoes in here because old-fashioned soldier shoes, they had nails in the bottom. You know what a spark is, don't you? You want a spark in here? No.
It's like...
Yep. And any spark, they wouldn't even wear metal belt buckles just because they were so concerned about sparking.
Today, that chalk message and the whole room bear traces of the vandalism that's been a problem in the bunkers since the Park Service took over in 1972. Historian Steve Haller explains.
Where John was just showing you the 1940 chalk work, somebody's put some graffiti over it. Now, graffiti once covered this entire room, and you can just barely make out just some of the faint ghosts of the graffiti that it took endless amounts of sweat equity to remove. But you'll also see over here, of course, we didn't remove it because removing the graffiti would have removed the historic chalk marks of the soldiers from World War II.
By 1994, the Army had handed over the Marin Headlands, the Presidio, and Fort Mason to the National Park Service. The land is now available for anyone, including vandals, to explore. Many more stories lie in these open lands, waiting for new generations to uncover them. In the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, this is Mary Reese for Cross Currents.
If you want to see the underground life of the Golden Gate Recreation Area, join a weekend tour. Battery Chamberlain in the Presidio is open on the first Saturday and Sunday of each month. You can tour Battery Townsley in the Marin Headlands on the first Sunday of every month. Check out our website, kalw.org, for the details. That's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Julie Kane, Tiffany Kamhai, Lisa Carmack, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Alyssa Kapnick, Christina Loring, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Leah Rose, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Eva Sonsin. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. The guitar you're hearing is being played by Teja Gürkan. He brought his finger-picking style here to the Bay Area from his native Germany. His next performance is tomorrow night at the Sleeping Lady in Fairfax. Music starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.